Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For decades, Flint got its water from the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, now the Great Lakes Water Authority. So why the push to build a new pipeline?
I don't believe KWA saves Flint money. I know it does.
That's later this hour. But first, Hillary Clinton has given her economic plan again in Michigan, like Mr. Trump did as well. Charlie Ballard with Michigan State University is with us. You know, as an economist, Charlie, I want to ask you, did you think the stage meant a lot? Because Trump, before the Economic Club of Detroit, Hillary at a manufacturing plant in Warren, does that make a difference? Does that send a message?
I think it probably sends something of a message. A lot of the folks who are at the Economic Club are business people, although Representative Debbie Dingell is a member of the Economic Club, and she, the Democratic representative, and she was there at Trump's speech. But I think the setting in a manufacturing facility was deliberate on the part of the Clinton campaign. They wanted to make the point that they are in favor of revitalizing the manufacturing sector. Of course, Mr. Trump would also say that he wants to revitalize the manufacturing sector, although the ways in which they would do those things are different.
Very, very different. So let's talk a little bit about her plans. She talked about a number of different things. Did you hear anything that was particularly surprising or innovative, or was it some of the things we've would come to expect from a Democratic candidate?
There weren't many surprises, really. Most of these things Secretary Clinton has talked about before. She just hasn't done it necessarily in the context of a big planned speech like this. But, you know, she's in favor of continuing the Affordable Care Act. Mr. Trump is not. That's no surprise. She's in favor of higher taxes on high-income and high-wealth individuals, and Mr. Trump would go in the opposite direction. Again, no surprise. One of the starkest differences between the two is on immigration. Maybe one thing that I think was, if not a surprise, at least it was an important moment. She came out pretty clearly against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this proposed new trade deal with 11 countries in the Pacific Rim. She had formerly been in favor of that, but Senator Sanders really made a big deal about that in his campaign, and that pressure from the Sanders wing of the Democratic Party convinced Clinton to change her mind. But one of her supporters said the other day that, well, she really doesn't mean that. But she came out and said it pretty clearly this time.
It's fairly explicit.
Yeah.
She did give herself just a little bit of wiggle room in that if it ruins jobs or ruins the economy, those were the caveats. But then she followed up saying, don't support it now, won't support it when I'm president. So I think that was a bit of a mixed message, maybe?
A little bit mixed. She basically did not close the door on future trade agreements, whereas Mr. Trump is awfully close to saying, we're not going to do anything on trade unless it's really very, very strongly renegotiated. I think Clinton really comes out more as, I'm with the status quo on trade. She acknowledged the problems that trade could cause, but also she talked about Michigan's companies that export, which is the upside of trade. Whereas Donald Trump is much more strident and much more aggressive on the trade issue.
All right. We've just got a couple of seconds to go. I want to ask you to contrast and compare the two speeches. Did either one of them come close to the truth of the Michigan economy?
Oh, I think actually that Clinton came closer to the truth. Maybe that's just because I'm inherently optimistic. Sure, we have problems. She acknowledged that. But I don't think that our economy is nearly as gloomy as Mr. Trump put it. Each of them, of course, wants to put their own spin on it. But she really was much more positive. After all, Trump's book is called Crippled America. So he has consistently been emphasizing the negatives.
That's Charlie Ballard. He's an economist at Michigan State University and one of our favorite go-to professors when it comes to things like this. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Lester.
Maybe you got a chance to listen to Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton this week as they gave their big economic speeches in Michigan. Joining us, as they do most Fridays, are Susan Demas, publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Ken Sikkema, a senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Ken, what stood out for you in these two speeches?
I thought they were pretty standard fare, fairly predictable if you look at kind of Republican-Democratic economic platform and speeches over the years. Trump is talking about cutting taxes and regulations, and Clinton's talking more about job creation value, public investments, and infrastructure. And I think there's one exception this year. That's the issue of international trade agreements. I think they're coming under fire clearly from Trump, and Clinton is sort of on the defensive a little bit there. But other than that, I thought it was pretty standard fare, frankly.
I want to talk about those trade agreements a little bit later. But Susan, I want to get your takeaway points of the two speeches.
I think Donald Trump was able to garner a lot of goodwill after his speech to the Detroit Economic Club. I mean, for one thing, he pretty much used House Speaker Paul Ryan's platform, which is highly popular amongst Republicans and business leaders. And he also kept his cool with protesters. You know, he later squandered that with several more controversies about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama being the founders of ISIS and so on and so forth. But we've come to expect that from him. Hillary Clinton was emphasizing unions probably more than the average Democrat would, but she was in Macomb County. That's a place that Donald Trump is winning despite being down 10 points in the state. She made a commitment that she would not enact TPP if she were elected, if it kills jobs. You know, there's still some wiggle room, but clearly she sees a potential weakness there. You know, and her speech was pretty standard Democratic fare, emphasizing the middle class and childcare credits that would impact everybody, not just people who, frankly, don't really need them, who are at more of the upper echelon.
I do want to talk about the trade agreements just a little more in depth. The one thing that Clinton and Trump agreed upon is opposition to the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. It's a reversal for Clinton, and it's out of character for a Republican. Ken, what's going on there?
Well, this is an area where Donald Trump has sort of realized the kind of angst over job losses because of trade agreements, as he would put it. Factories closing, you look at Michigan, it's happened in Michigan, and he's sort of sensed that over his campaign, and that's different than a typical Republican approach. He's criticizing these trade agreements, points out that Bill Clinton signed NAFTA. He's against the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. This is really, I think, key to his campaign in terms of sensing this angst among particularly white males.
Susan, I want to throw the tough question at you. How fair is it to blame the decline in manufacturing in Michigan or the rest of the nation on trade agreements such as the North American Free Trade Agreement?
I think that it's an easy argument to make. You know, there's a lot of frustration and anger about the declining number of manufacturing jobs in Michigan and other places, but there are myriad reasons for that. There's automation, there's the fact that we've been undercut in Michigan by non-union shops down south. You know, it's not just overseas. So I think Donald Trump discovered early on that he tapped into a vein of anger with economic populism in the Republican primary, and trade agreements, you know, are part of that. But, you know, he was really emphasizing pretty standard Republican policies of eliminating the estate tax and lowering tax rates and lowering corporate tax rates, things that Republicans in general really respond to, not the economic platform that got him here in the first place in the Republican primary.
I want to ask both of you, why do you think the candidates chose Michigan as the site for these major addresses on the economy?
Well, Michigan is, I think, part of the Midwest epicenter for the loss of manufacturing jobs. Clearly, it's hurt Michigan over time, so that's a good reason to be here. Is Michigan in play? Well, yeah, I think it is, although right now the polling indicates she has a substantial lead. You know, Trump probably has to win this state or Pennsylvania or one of these big Midwestern states that's lost a lot of these manufacturing jobs.
Susan?
Well, Donald Trump has said repeatedly that Michigan is key to his strategy for winning the presidency. And so, you know, what better place to give an economic address, especially when he needs to court the business and political elites in the Republican Party? I mean, the Detroit Economic Club is the place to go. I think Clinton's decision to quickly schedule her own stop in Michigan shows that she's not taking anything for granted. She went right to Macomb County, where she's losing, and, you know, she's not willing to cede Michigan.
Finally, there's been lots of fact-checking by media outlets on these two speeches. I'm kind of wondering, on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being not very true at all to 5 being sterling truth, how do you think each candidate did on the truthiness scale? Ken, let's start with you. Give us your truthiness scale for Trump and then for Clinton.
Frankly, I don't think this economic issue is going to determine much of the outcome. I think this is going to be a referendum on Donald Trump's personality.
Susan?
Well, I think fact checks show that both of them stretched the truth. I think Trump stretched it more. But in this election, I think Ken is correct. It's not going to be these policy speeches that define the election. And that's not certainly what gets most of the headlines. Where Donald Trump really runs into trouble is when he starts shooting his mouth off on Twitter and in speeches, you know, and when he, you know, called for either the assassination of Hillary Clinton or judges. I mean, that just blows any kind of truth, you know, scale out of the water. And that's what makes this race, I think, different than ones I've covered before.
Susan Demas is the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Thanks to both of you for taking some time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, our next artisan of Michigan says, don't throw out your old couch. Get it reupholstered. Then, a new effort is underway to get more people to the Sanilac Petroglyphs, the least visited park in the state, and the kiss that was seen around the world. That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. We live in a throwaway society. Things are made cheaply, and when we're finished with them, we toss them out. It goes for furniture, too. People put couches out on the curb. In a college town such as Ann Arbor at the end of the year, there are lots of couches at the curb. In East Lansing, I think they burn them. But we used to reupholster furniture. In fact, some people still do. And in this installment of our series, Artisans of Michigan, we visit an upholsterer. In a quiet neighborhood in Ann Arbor, we met Carol Butcher, who runs her business, The Great Cover-Up, out of her home. Now, Butcher used to work in the corporate world for 20 years. She was out of work for a short time and started recovering furniture as a hobby. Then she got another pretty good corporate job, and she hated it.
All I kept thinking about was upholstery. So, believe it or not, I put in my notice after a few weeks of work. I started doing upholstery for a living. First 2 years, pretty darn scary. But now, I think I've been doing this for 13, 14 years. And I'm constantly busy. I have like a 3 to 5 month backlog at any given time. And I love what I do. And I found out I'm good at it.
Butcher was told if she loved doing upholstery as a hobby, she really shouldn't turn it into a business because she'd end up hating it. She ignored that advice, and she still loves it. She spends a lot of time in her basement workshop, surrounded by sewing machines, bolts of fabric, and hand tools. Most of the work, almost all of it, is done by hand. She says there's something therapeutic about the work. In fact, she sometimes has a sort of Tom Sawyer whitewashing the fence thing going on.
I have friends who are more than willing to come over and do what I'm doing right now just because it's just satisfying. So I think satisfaction would probably be the first thing. It's very satisfying. Really, who doesn't want to hammer things? Who doesn't want to see the transformation as you work through it?
She even tried to get me to give it a try. Yeah, no, I know that trick. Butcher says The Great Cover-Up is working out well enough that she can kind of pick and choose the job she wants to do. She'll refer some customers to other upholsterers in the area. She likes working on antique pieces. Not exclusively, but she finds them more challenging. Which brings us back to that whole throwaway society question.
When is it cost-effective to get something upholstered?
I tell people it's cost-effective if you've got a really solid frame. It's something that's going to last for a while. And then the time and the money that we put into it is going to pay off. If you've bought a sofa that was more economically priced to begin with, the frame is a little dodgy, the padding gets shot pretty quickly, then no, it's not worth it. A lot of times, though, somebody might buy a $10 chair at the garage sale, and it's got a fabulous frame. So I tell them, it will be worth it.
Carol Butcher of The Great Cover-Up in Ann Arbor, the latest in our series, Artisans of Michigan. The least visited park in the state is the site of some of its very oldest historic artifacts. The Department of Natural Resources, Office of Historic Preservation, and members of the Saginaw Chippewa tribe want to encourage more visitors to the Sanilac Petroglyphs Historic State Park. Joining me now is Stacy Trzynski. She's an archaeologist at the Michigan State Historic Preservation Office. And Shannon Martin, the director of the Zeebowing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways. Stacy, where is this park?
The park is in the Thumb region of Michigan. It is near Cass City and Bad Axe. It's in a deeply rural area. It's 240 acres of floodplain forest along the Cass River, surrounded by agricultural land.
Shannon, I want to ask you what makes this site special. But before we get to that, I want to ask you about the proper way to identify your people or your tribe. You're with the Anishinaabe Center, but we also hear Ojibwa and Chippewa, as I mentioned earlier. Which should we use or not use? Which is proper?
Those are all proper.
Oh, good.
Absolutely. Chippewa is the federal government recognized name for the Saginaw Chippewa Indian Tribe of Michigan. However, our oldest language, it refers to Ojibwe. So there was a slight inflection during the government treaty era signing times with the language, and Ojibwe turned into Chippewa. But Anishinaabe is the term in the Ojibwe language that refers to the original people. So it would be Chippewa, Ojibwe, Anishinaabe, or Potawatomi Anishinaabe, or Ottawa Anishinaabe. It's the people.
The people, which is what I had been told in the past, that, you know, when you refer to your tribe, you refer to the people because we are the people. What is this site? Why is it special to the Chippewa tribe?
This site is special because it is a permanent place of spiritual understanding, reflection, and teaching for the Anishinaabe people. So not just the Ojibwe, but the Ottawa, Potawatomi, the Lenni Lenape, and those tribes that called Michigan home at one time that were Aboriginal here. So tribes that were removed or migrated to other parts of America, say like the Kickapoo, Sac and Fox, Miami. This site is significant to all of us because on that grandfather stone, we call it, or grandmother stone, contains very important teachings and messages that our ancestors left for us for future generations to learn from, to understand, and to take that knowledge and carry it into the future.
Now, we call these petroglyphs, and I want Stacy to explain to me what a petroglyph is.
Petroglyphs are carvings in stone as opposed to something like a pictograph, which is a drawing or painting on stone. So they're carvings in rock. From an archaeological point of view, they are just that, carvings in rock, but from a tribal perspective, they are teachings in rock.
So what kind of outcropping of rock is this? I mean, what kind of stone are we talking about,
first? It's a very soft Marshall sandstone, and this is a landscape that was created millions of years ago, and then through glaciation, about 13,000 years ago, the Ubli Channel went through the area, a wide riverbed, and that deposited sediments that over time became the soft Marshall sandstone and created the whole Cass River waterway. With the development of the Cass River system, it unlocked these outcrops of Marshall sandstone, and those were the outcrops that First Peoples came and placed the carvings on.
So let's talk about those petroglyphs. What are some of these symbols? What do they mean?
One symbol in particular, probably the most prominent one that people recognize on that particular site, is called Emnodokwit in the language, and that's the shooter of knowledge into the future. The archaeologists and those that the historians call it the archer. But that carving in itself is a reminder to all people who see that our ancestors thought about us. They had great intention to leave those teachings on that rock for us to learn from one day. And that particular Emnodokwit is representational of those ancestors. Shooting
so
knowledge.
Shoot an arrow seven generations in the
into
future.
The future. Yeah. And then the body of Emnodokwit is an arrow as well. if you go and visit the site, which we hope you do, the arrow of the body is going directly to the creator. So that means that we always have the direct connection to our creator.
How many sites of petroglyphs are there around the nation?
Around the nation, there are hundreds. Most people think of petroglyphs and they think of the American Southwest. In the Great Lakes region, there are the Peterborough petroglyphs in Ontario. There's the Jeffers petroglyphs in Minnesota. And most people don't know that we have petroglyphs right here in Michigan.
So it's fairly rare in the Great Lakes region.
It is fairly rare for the United States portion of the Great Lakes region, yes.
And I assume part of this is because if it's this kind of loose sandstone, it's going to be weather-worn pretty easily. What's being done to protect the petroglyphs at this site?
It's a challenge. Being soft Marshall sandstone, it's susceptible to freeze and thaw and touch and sunshine and moss and lichen. And there's no perfect way to protect a site like this. It was meant to be in this floodplain landscape. The carvings are connected to its natural landscape. It was meant to be in an open, natural environment. What the state of Michigan had done since they had acquired the property was they built an awning over it in the 80s to try to protect it from some weathering and rain and snow. And what we think that might be doing is not letting enough sunlight onto the rock. And so we get moss and lichen that
does its own damage.
Grow from the rock and does its own damage. So it's a balance between trying to learn what the site needs from a technical preservation point of view and what it also needs from a cultural preservation point of view. And the state of Michigan is being taught that piece by our tribes.
Both of you, though, want more visitors to the site. Both of you want to let people in the state and around the Great Lakes region to know about this. But I read in an Associated Press story that there's a chain link fence topped with barbed wire. That doesn't sound like you're encouraging visitors. What's going on there?
We're working on that, too. Currently, the site is open from Wednesday through Sundays from Memorial Day to Labor Day. The trails are always open. The park is open, but there's an enclosure that surrounds the pavilion above the carvings. Unfortunately, over the years, people have taken it upon themselves to leave graffiti and disrespect and mistreat the site. And the worst offenses of those actually happened prior to the 1920s and 1930s, where some of the carvings were actually chipped out and stolen. And a lot of graffiti was left. And you can even see graffiti that was left by 19th century loggers on the rock. And unfortunately, graffiti is a phenomenon that happens at rock art sites worldwide. It's something that's very hard to prevent. In the earlier years, the DNR erected this fence around the pavilion when it was not being interpreted during open hours. They wanted to keep people from disrespecting, stealing, vandalism. And it is not the most elegant solution. And part of what we're doing now is working on a series of grants for a series of solutions at the site, not only to reinterpret it multivocally and from a tribal-led perspective, but also to look at the conservation of the stone itself, what it needs, how much light is this covering working, what is this fence doing or really not doing. And we want to come up with some more culturally appropriate and welcoming solutions that physically protect the area because we all want to see it last as long as it can, but also be more respectful to the natural context that it sits in. And the fence isn't doing that, but at the same time, it's a challenge to come up with an appropriate physical barrier that can protect the site when it's not being monitored. It's a beautiful park with trails and amazing brand new interpretive signage that we just put up that's bilingual in English and Anishinaabe Mo'en, and there's a lot to see, and the petroglyphs are very much there to see. So it's a gorgeous park. It's a gem of a park.
It sounds like it's a tough balance to encourage people to come see, recognize, and at the same time protect these petroglyphs. I mean, you're on the air right now encouraging people to come and visit this site. When they get there, are you going to be able to handle it and keep it all under control in a way that preserves the site?
Yeah, those are, you know, some of the tough questions that we're grappling with, and these grants are helping to facilitate those discussions. Stacy and I were part of a 5-year grant program called Intellectual Property Issues in Cultural Heritage, and that project was administered through Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. Through that grant, our case study was focused solely on the Santa Monica petroglyphs, looking at the cultural preservation versus intellectual property issues, what could be shared, what couldn't be shared spiritually and from an Anishinaabe perspective. And then we were looking at long-term preservation of the site and the carvings. What could we come up with as a best solution to preserve the site as long as possible? So we actually took a trip to Peterborough to visit the glyphs there. There's a wonderful relationship going on between the Curve Lake First Nation Ojibwe and the Ministry of Natural Resources, the Parks in Ontario. They actually have an enclosure, a temperature and humidity controlled covering building over their petroglyphs. So we went there and we learned from both sides, from the government side and from the tribal perspective, what worked and what didn't work. So that's really, you know, something as a foundation to inform us in our work as we look at developing a future management and preservation plan for Sanilac.
That's Shannon Martin. She's the director of the Zibwing Center of Anishinaabe Culture and Lifeways. Also, we've been hearing from Stacy Chorzinski. She's an archaeologist at the Michigan State Historic Preservation Office and the Department of Natural Resources. Thanks very much for both of you coming in and explaining the site to us.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Monday marks the 71st anniversary of VJ Day, Victory Over Japan. August 15th, 1945 was a day of jubilation, as you can hear in this newsreel report.
The victory flash electrified Times Square, keyed to the bursting point as the magic word of complete surrender came through. It was the long-awaited moment, and the lid was off. Unparalleled were the scenes as multitudes surged around Miss Liberty, throwing restraint to the winds.
One of the most famous photographs of that day in New York was taken by Alfred Eisenstadt. It depicts a sailor kissing a woman dressed in white in Times Square. Joining me now is Russell Levine. He's vice president of the Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial. The kiss in that photo certainly was not the only kiss of that day. Can you describe that moment and why people were kissing perfect strangers?
Well, it was a moment of pure jubilation. You know, the war had started on December 7th, 1941, and now it was ending. And people were just getting over the fact that all those years of deprivation and sacrifice and lost lives and service were coming to an end. And the long-dreaded invasion of Japan was not, in fact, going to occur.
Now, you're holding an event in Royal Oak on Sunday, and a 25-foot statue depicting that Times Square kiss will be featured. What are you asking people to do at your gathering?
Show up. Okay, that's the first thing we want people to do. So it'll be 1 o'clock on Sunday, October 14th in Memorial Park in Royal Oak. It's the northeast corner of Woodward Avenue and 13 Mile Road. And then we're going to reenact the kiss. So we're going to get as many people as possible to either kiss or just be cheering onlookers, because that's what the pandemonium was like in Times Square. And this is not the only one of these events that's going on. This is part of an international celebration. There are similar statues and locations across the country and in France. And there'll be similar celebrations at all those locations as well. So this is everybody's chance in Michigan to be a part of that.
Now, tell me about the statue a little bit. We said it was 25 feet tall. Why was it constructed? What's it made of? How unique is it? Tell me a little bit about it.
Sure. Well, it's made out of bronze, 7.5 tons. And there are four of these 25-foot versions, as I said, across the world. There's one in Sarasota, San Diego. Then there's two that travel. One's in France, and then one is in Royal Oak. And then there are several life-size versions of the statue as well that are in different locations throughout the country. It's meant as a celebration of the end of the war. It's at the future site of the Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial, which is the state's official tribute to its contributions to World War II on the home front and the war front, because we were, of course, the arsenal of democracy and the home of Rosie the Riveter. And so what we're trying to do is draw attention to our $3 million fundraising goal. We want people to come out, donate, and help us spread the word. We can raise the money if enough people know about this project, and we think a 25-foot statue is going to be kind of hard to miss.
Now, we understand that you were asking for people to show up dressed in sort of the costume, sailor suits and then all white or nurse's suits. And I know you've had Rosie the Riveter costumes, people dressed up like Rosie the Riveter there before. Is that required to take part in this big kiss?
Oh, no. It's purely optional. But I will tell you that we will have actual veterans. We will have actual Rosies, along with reenactors as well, for people to take pictures with. But, yeah, please come as you are or dress up. If you dress up, it's more fun, but it's certainly not required.
Now, I saw even if someone's not able to make the event in Royal Oak on Sunday, you're asking them to participate in social media or on social media. In what way?
That's right. We call it Kiss and Tell 5. So if everybody goes to the website kissandtell5.org, they'll see all the details. But basically, we're telling people, go ahead and recreate the kiss, even if you're not at the site, and then post it on social media. You can use the hashtag kissandtell5. And then if you go to kissandtell5.org, you can make a donation. And then it's kissandtell5 because we want you to tell 5 friends about this as well, and then have them take a picture and then tell 5 friends and so on and so on.
That's Russell Levine. He's the vice president of the Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial. They're having an event at 1 o'clock at Memorial Park in Royal Oak, and they're going to be recreating that famous kiss in Times Square to celebrate the end of the war in Japan. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, why health care insurance is on the rise and how it's affecting you.
You know, a lot of people, instead of avoiding unnecessary care, actually are avoiding necessary care as well.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For the first time, researchers show how much patients with private insurance actually pay for hospital stays. Out-of-pocket costs are high and rising fast in many plans, even those considered good insurance. Emily Adrian is a research fellow at the University of Michigan Medical School. She and her team looked into the rising out-of-pocket costs to people with private insurance. So you found costs skyrocketing in two areas. Let's start with the one we're all familiar with, deductibles.
Deductibles went up about 86% between 2009 and 2013. And the idea behind deductibles is to prevent overuse of healthcare.
Right. You've got skin in the game.
Right. You have skin in the game. If you have a high deductible, you're going to think twice before going to the doctor for something that may be unnecessary.
Is there a justifiable reason that the insurance plans are raising the deductibles?
That's a question mark right now. You know, a lot of people, instead of avoiding unnecessary care, actually are avoiding necessary care as well. So I think there are a lot of question marks around deductibles and especially the recent rise in deductibles.
The other area costing patients more is co-insurance. We're less familiar with that. So tell us what that is and how fast it's rising.
Co-insurance is actually a percentage of the cost of care that the patient is responsible for. If you go in for an appendectomy, the insurance company will pay about 70%, and then your co-insurance means that you're responsible for 30% of the cost of that care.
What's been happening with that cost?
Co-insurance is increasing as well. So more people are paying co-insurance, and the size of co-insurance has been increasing as well. We found that it increased about 33% between 2009 and 2013.
We all know that premiums are going up as well, so we're paying more for insurance. It's rising about 5% a year. At what rate are the total of out-of-pocket costs rising?
Total out-of-pocket costs are rising by 37% right now.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a big increase. And actually, if you look at the annual increase, that's about a 6.5% increase each year between 2009 and 2013. That might not sound very big, but when you compare it to premium increases, premiums have risen about 5.1% over the same time period. And that was actually a period of an overall slowdown in healthcare cost growth. Overall healthcare costs were growing at just 2.9% over that same time period.
So this means people are getting hit at both ends of the plan, paying more for the insurance, paying more for out-of-pocket costs. What's the average hospital stay costing people these days?
For people in employer-sponsored plans, about $1,013 per visit.
I read in a Washington Post blog, which, by the way, quotes you, it reminded us of a Federal Reserve survey which found nearly half of Americans don't have enough money to cover a $400 expense, emergency expense. So a bill of $1,000 that you're talking about would be kind of a gut punch to a lot of families. They're going to find themselves in dire straits. What could be done about this squeeze from the insurance plans so that people can keep it at a level that's not going to devastate their household financing?
Well, this is a huge issue. I mean, I'm a research fellow. I don't make a ton of money either, and $1,000 would be a lot to me as well. So I understand this issue. But the Affordable Care Act introduced out-of-pocket maximums for all of the plans on the marketplace. So that's about $7,000 for individuals and $1,400 for families who are purchasing coverage. A lot of employer-sponsored plans do have out-of-pocket maximums, but they're not required. And so I think maybe having some sort of requirement to contain the overall costs for catastrophic costs anyway would be one step. Another step is just education of patients and consumers of healthcare. There was a 2013 study that showed that only 14% of people really have a good understanding of what copayments, deductibles, and coinsurance are. And if you don't understand those topics, then it's really hard to choose a health insurance plan that's best for you and one that can help keep your costs down.
So is this something that the healthcare industry and the insurance industries are actually kind of trying to work on, or are they butting heads as one's trying to recover costs from the other all the time and the consumer gets caught up in the middle of that?
I don't know that they're working together. I would assume that they'd try. it's really difficult. They have competing interests and, you know, consumers are sort of caught in the middle and we have a knowledge gap. And when you're really sick and you have to go to the hospital, you don't have a lot of time to shop around if you have an appendectomy or you're having a heart attack. And even if we try to shop around, it's not always possible to get the cheapest care.
I was really surprised this is the first time anybody's taken a look at this. What prompted you to do this?
As you mentioned earlier, there are a lot of news stories about the 4- and 5-digit hospital bills that uninsured and underinsured people face, but there's really almost nothing known about people with more high-quality health insurance coverage and how much they're paying. And we really wanted to look into this and see what was going on, and we had access to this great data set that had a lot of rich information. And it's hard to get access to private employer-sponsored, private insurer data because it's proprietary and it's just difficult to get a hold of it and see what was going on. And I think we were a bit taken aback by the high increases in costs over time.
Apparently so, and a lot of media have picked up on your study, and you know, I think it is surprising to everyone. Emily Adrian is a research fellow at the University of Michigan Medical School, telling us how even people with high-quality health insurance are paying a lot more in out-of-pocket costs these days. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You might have heard an interview with Wayne State University professor Peter Hammer earlier this week. Cynthia Canty talked to him about a paper he wrote in which he argued there were more players in the events that led to the lead contamination of Flint's drinking water than the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Health and Human Services. Among the entities mentioned in that paper were the Department of Treasury, which made many of the final decisions leading up to the switch to the Flint River for a water supply. It also mentioned the Carignan-Ndi Water Authority, the entity building a pipeline from Lake Huron to Genesee County, the KWA. KWA objected to some of the characterizations of its role and asked to be on the program, and we agreed. Jeff Wright is the Genesee County Drain Commissioner. He's also the CEO of the KWA, and he joins us now. Let's start at the beginning. Flint got its water from the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, now the Great Lakes Water Authority, for decades. What began the push to build the KWA pipeline?
There are multiple reasons. One, and probably the main reason, is the fact that there was going to be a second pipeline built. Detroit publicly had stated after 2 years of negotiating with us and Flint that for reliability and for public health reasons, a second pipeline had to be built. They hired Tucker Young to design that second pipeline, spent $30 million, and we simultaneously looked at the option of building our own pipeline. And lo and behold, we could put it in for a third the price that Tucker Young had estimated for the city of Detroit. So reliability was a very key factor, and that was based on the 2003 power outage that left our area without water totally.
Well, let's talk about why that's important. You've got several pump stations that bring the water from the Detroit region to Flint. That's what you're talking about?
Well, in 2003, that's correct. There's pump stations that used to pump water and still do water to our area. The power outage of 2003 left those pump stations inoperable, so Flint and Genesee County was totally out of water for 4 days.
How would that be different with the KWA pipeline? You still have to have pumps to get it from Lake Huron to Flint.
We have two pump stations. They have not only two different power feeds from Detroit Edison, but backup power generation capability.
Okay, so you're talking about reliability. There's one point. The city of Flint, I'm wondering what it would gain by getting KWA water instead of Detroit, because KWA will deliver untreated water from Lake Huron. The Flint Water Treatment Plant did not adequately treat the water from the Flint River. That treatment plant needs tens of millions of dollars in upgrades to be ready to treat Lake Huron water. Plus, there are costs to be borne to pay for this new pipeline. So how is this better for Flint?
Well, the reality of this is some of the misinformation that Professor Hammer put out there. It doesn't require millions of dollars to upgrade that plant to treat lake water, which is much easier and less costly to treat than river water. And the estimate to upgrade that is about $7 million. And while we're on
that
subject,
where's
that
figure come from? Because the two figures cited in Professor Hammer's paper was $64 million and then $25 million. Now you're saying $7
million. Well, again, Mr. Hammer leaves out a lot of information. And where he comes up with his data, I have no idea. There's a Roe report engineering firm that says it will take $7.5 million to upgrade the plant to treat lake water. The $62 million he refers to was to upgrade the plant to treat river water, which is accurate. Flint and the state did not spend that $62 million.
So you're saying $7 million. That's still $7 million that Flint doesn't have. In fact, you know, one of the reports indicated that Flint's water mains are leaking or otherwise losing between 40% to 60% of the treated water.
Separate, Lester.
Well, but
they
it's
leak
important.
Whether they're on the Detroit system or whether they're on the KWA system.
I understand, but there's a point behind that, and that is they couldn't even take a loan out that was going to be forgiven by 50% to fix the pipes to do that. So where are they going to get the money to fix the water plant?
Well, the facts are there were $42 million in their water and sewer reserves, the Flint system. At the time that this was taking place, it's documented in court records because of a lawsuit one of the council members has with the city over raising of the water rates, $42 million in reserve funds in their water system. So the money is there. You can't take Professor Hammer's statements as fact without looking at the real facts documented that are left out of his report.
So this reserve funds, if the emergency manager was aware of this, why wasn't that money used to fix up the water plant, fix up the infrastructure?
I can't speak for why they didn't do it. I can only speak for the fact that the money was there. The other thing, when we're on the financial aspect, Mr. Hammer refers that somehow there's got to be a new revenue stream to pay for KWA. What he leaves out is the fact that Detroit was charging, and now the Great Lakes Water Authority was charging so much that the cost of KWA and the cost to treat KWA water is less than the cost just to purchase water from those two entities. So there was no new revenue required to pay off this bond debt. The bond debt to Flint is $7 million annually for KWA. Their 2013 payment to Detroit was $13 million just to purchase water.
Is that because of all of this leakage, which is going to happen under either deal? I mean, could they have reduced the amount of money they were paying to Detroit?
It has nothing to do with the leakage. The leakage is there, whether they're on the Detroit system or on KWA.
Here's what I'm asking you, though. When they pay for water from Detroit, is it a flat rate, or are they paid by the amount of water they pump into the city?
It's based on the amount of water pumped into the city. And if we're going to talk about that aspect of it, then you also have to add in the fact that Detroit itself has a 38% leakage that we pay for before it even gets here.
That is, as you have pointed out, a separate deal, and we're talking about Flint and whether it's better off with Detroit Water or KWA. As drain commissioner, you bought water from Flint that was actually originated in Detroit and then redistributed it to other municipalities in Genesee County. If Detroit Water was good enough for that, why is it not good enough now? I'm just not sure.
Two reasons. I've already mentioned one. The reliability of the system. When Detroit admits that they've got to build a second pipeline and we're going to charge us for it, basically, don't get past that point and forget it. There's going to be and was going to be a second pipeline built. It was a matter of who was going to build it and who was going to pay for it. Second reason, Detroit double-digit rate increased to us and Flint 14 years straight, tripling what we pay for water. The third reason is the corruption and cronyism that was taking place in that system. And actually, according to Brooks Patterson, quoted publicly, the corruption and cronyism is still in the Great Lakes Water Authority. Those were the three major factors to get us off the system. They were going to build a pipeline. They priced themselves out of the water and the questionable practices that they still, to this day, put in place.
When did you get the governor and treasurer to sign off on this project? Because they've gone ahead with KWA, and I'm wondering why the state signed on, even though they had to do some finagling themselves in order to find the money to do it.
Well, the money's there. It's just being, instead of paying it to the City of Detroit or Great Lakes Water Authority, it pays the bond debt for KWA. But you're assuming that Governor Snyder got this project going. The KWA, the Carrick-Nandi, was approved under the Granholm administration, under the Great Lakes Water Compact.
Not Flint's part of it, though. That's what I'm talking about. Under emergency manager, the Treasury and the governor said, okay, let's go.
Well, that's not true either.
It is true. Andy Dillon even says he signed off on it.
The professor again left out many, many votes by the Flint City Council.
Which had no authority to make a vote on that.
See, and you're jumping to his conclusions. The Flint City Council voted back in 2009 and 10 to join the KWA. They voted again to bring in the Articles of Incorporation and the bylaws. The only vote you're talking about and the professor's talking about is the capacity contract vote. There were multiple votes by that Flint City Council long before there was an emergency manager to be part of KWA.
But none of those committed it.
Well, actually, some of those votes committed hundreds of thousands of dollars in pre-engineering
and studies,
preliminary engineering.
In studies, right.
That's right.
So I guess I want to boil this down. You think, you're saying, you believe that KWA is going to be a really good deal for Flint. It's going to be lowering the water rates for Flint citizens, and the fact that KWA, by no fault of its own, the whole circumstance of KWA led to the fact that Flint switched to the Flint River for
what
a water
source.
What led
Flint to the Flint River was the termination letter by the City of Detroit, which the professor also blows off as nothing that's important. They received a termination letter from Detroit that said, get off the system within 12 months. And then turned around and said, and if you don't get off the system, you have to sign a 30-year contract with us. Your original point, I don't believe KWA saves Flint money. I know it does. It's documented. The Tucker Young report has been proven to be inaccurate, but yet it's held up by the professor and others as if it's something that means anything. They were off by over $60 million, and the proof of that is the project's been completed. The money's been paid out. Our numbers were accurate. Theirs were not.
That's the report that the Treasury Department also didn't give to the City Council when they made their vote, right?
I don't know if they gave it to them or not. I don't. I assumed that they were aware of it because it was discussed. You know, that's another point. There seems to be this idea that there was only one City Council meeting that debated this issue. There were four nights of debate. All of these things were talked about. But the bottom line to all of this is, and the financial advisors, the engineers, the bond councils, anybody that's looked at it with honesty can show categorically that it saves the people of Flint tens of millions of dollars to own and operate their own system with reliability as opposed to purchasing water from another community that has reliability problems.
That's Jeff Wright. He is the Genesee County Drain Commissioner, also the CEO of the KWA. Thanks very much for talking and explaining some of this to us.
My pleasure, Lester.
We tried to confirm the $42 million reserve fund that Mr. Wright mentioned. We asked Flint's utilities director. She was not aware of the funds. We reached out to the current and the former city finance directors and the City of Flint spokesperson. They couldn't immediately confirm the existence of the reserve fund. We'll keep working on that. And that's our show for today. Join us again Monday for Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.